Hey, Derek, welcome back to the show.
Hey, hey.
Have you talked to your wife about locking down her social media accounts and her digital devices?
I actually did not because of this story that we're going to talk about, but I have talked with her in the past. Not that I feel like I'm the most well-known famous reporter out there, but I've talked to her about, like, you do know if you get, you know, weird emails or texts from me or from my number or something like that that are weird, that you need to verify that, or you need to find some way to make sure that that's not someone spoofing my number. Yeah, she has an idea, but
good. I'm glad to hear that. We're going to be talking about spouses getting targeted today as part of a Chinese operation targeting high profile targets in the United States, including politicians and dissidents. And one way that they're going after these targets is by attacking their spouses. So if you're listening to this and you haven't talked to your partner, your family about locking down their devices, their accounts, this will be a good reminder for you to do that. Later on the show today, we've also got an interview with Byron Tao about his new book about data brokers. So that's coming up today on Safe Mode.
Welcome to Safe Mode. I'm Elias Grohl, senior editor at CyberScoop. Every week, we break down the most pressing issues in technology, provide you the knowledge and the tools to stay ahead of the latest threats, and take you behind the scenes of the biggest stories in cybersecurity.
An attack is coming.
It's about keeping us safe.
He's just a disgruntled hacker.
She's a super hacker. Stay alert.
Stay safe.
Stay safe.
This is Safe Mode.
I'm Elias Grohl, the host of Safe Mode, and I'm joined today by Derek B. Johnson, CyberScoop reporter. Welcome back to the show, Derek.
Always a pleasure.
So this week, the United States unveiled sanctions and an indictment targeting a group of Chinese hackers. What does the U.S. government allege that this group of individuals and a company have done?
Yeah, so the U.S. government indicted seven individuals, all Chinese nationals, for this really sprawling set of hacking activity going back to 2010. It targeted thousands of foreign politicians, government officials, foreign policy experts, in some cases, political campaigns, as well as companies, all believed to be for espionage for political intelligence. They also sanctioned a company that is based in Wuhan, as well as two individuals at that company. The U.S. government says that company's a front for APT-31, which is one of the major Chinese hacking groups that is managed by the Ministry of State Security.
So this is coming at a time when officials in Washington are warning of increasingly advanced and aggressive Chinese hacking operations targeting a variety of institutions, critical infrastructure entities in the United States and elsewhere. How does this indictment kind of fit into the broader picture of what we've been learning about Chinese operations in recent memory?
Yeah, so a lot of the warnings that were around critical infrastructure were for sort of a different Chinese group that we call Volt Typhoon and some other names. That is believed to be more about sort of pre-positioning for potential conflicts with the United States in the future, burrowing into critical infrastructure so that they could sort of flip the switch if they needed to and disrupt if the conflict got to a heated place. This activity in the indictments yesterday is much more about espionage. It's much more about gaining insights into how Western policymakers are thinking about issues, how they're approaching issues. That has really been APT-31's primary remit. And despite the targeting of some senior campaign officials in the Biden and Trump campaign in 2020, this wasn't really characterized by U.S. officials as a election interference or sort of election meddling type operation. It's much more about feeding intelligence about what China's geopolitical enemies are doing and thinking back to the government.
So at the same time that the U.S. unveiled the indictment and these sanctions, we also got a statement out of the UK government accusing China of targeting UK election infrastructure and some UK politicians. Talk us through the British angle on this story.
Yeah, so it was the British government. New Zealand Act came out later in the day and said that their parliamentarians were targeted by APT 31. Canada said that in an unspecified way, they were also targeted. But with the British side, there were two real hacks, two real operations here that they were sanctioning this same company and these two individuals for. One was for targeting, well, we know of at least three British members of parliament who had their devices and accounts targeted by APT 31. The other side of that is the Electoral Commission, which holds a sort of basic voter information. About 40 million British voters they were hacked in 2021. The British government attributed the targeting of the parliamentarians specifically to APT 31, which means specifically to the Ministry of State Security, and they attributed the Electoral Commission hack just to China actors more broadly. So there's a little bit of ambiguity there.
So let's step back a bit and talk more about the tactics that were described in the indictment. The Chinese hackers that we're talking about here are quite aggressive, and they're really willing to go after anyone as part of this operation to try to penetrate people's kind of digital lives. How are they going about doing this?
Yeah, so I mean, there's certainly a lot of the traditional hacking techniques that we know about. But one of the things that China is very aggressive about in a variety of different ways and contexts is they are not afraid to target or go after members of your family, whether it's your spouse, whether it's your kids, who are probably operating on devices that have lower levels of security. They may have less security-minded training. And one of the ways that they sort of tried to get at some of their primary targets was they would send emails to not just the officials, but also members of their family that weren't necessarily about infecting them with malware. They would try and get them to click on these tracking links that would convey a certain amount of information about the device that the person was using, their operating system, sort of certain network schematics, and then use that as a way to try and compromise home office routers and networks. And there's sort of debate about what exactly they were trying to do with that aspect and what you could do with that information. But according to the indictment, at least, that was sort of a direct result of some of the targeting of family members was to get that information to set up follow-on operations.
One of my favorite little nuggets from the indictment was that these hackers were also impersonating prominent journalists to try to get government officials to click on malicious links. What was the journalist impersonation angle on this story?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little unclear as to who was being sent, these emails from journalists specifically. But you know, the idea here is, certainly China is not above and sort of is known for impersonating, individuals. It's sort of a way to kind of get in. And if you are a government official and you are sent a link by a journalist to a story, you're probably gonna have some curiosity about clicking on it, depending how it's set up, depending on how it's presented to you. So it's a very clever way, I think, to get people's guards down where they otherwise might have their antenna up for phishing links or things like that.
All right, Derek, thanks so much for your reporting on this. And if you're listening to this and you think you might be a target of Chinese hacking, have a conversation with your spouse.
Thank you.
Coming up next on Safe Mode, I'm joined by Byron Tao, whose new book is an eye-opening look at the data broker industry and all the ways we are tracked online and our data bundled and sold. My interview with Byron Tao is up next. To be a person in the world today is to be incessantly tracked, your data collected and aggregated, and then sold off to the highest bidder. Many of us intuitively understand this, but the technologies, companies, and policies that make all of this possible is to most of us something of a mystery. Reporter Byron Tao has done groundbreaking work to help us understand the privacy nightmare that is modern life. And his new book, Means of Control, How the Hidden Alliance of Tech and Government is Creating a New American Surveillance State, is a must read for anyone who wants to understand the modern data economy. Byron was a reporter for many years at the Wall Street Journal and is now with the nonprofit newsroom Notice. Byron Tao, welcome to Safe Mode.
Thanks for having me.
So reading your book over the last couple of days has been a really eye-opening experience for me. I've been reading your work off and on for the past decade, and it was really great to just kind of have all your work put together all in one place. And you start off with a story that I think some folks in Washington might know somewhat well, but I think is worth returning to. And that's the story that you start the book with, which is from 2019, with a character named Mike Yeagley.
Yeagley,
and what he discovered about Grindr, the LGBTQ dating app. I wonder if you might tell us a bit about Mike and what he found.
Sure. So Mike's actually an interesting character because he was sort of playing both sides of this market and both selling a capability to government based on data that was available for sale. But in this instance, he was doing sort of a defensive counterintelligence demonstration. And what he did was essentially purchase a large amount of mobile cell phone data that showed the movement of phones around the world. This kind of data is available commercially. I write about it a lot in the book. And he primarily focused on data that was being generated from the app Grindr. And he went looking for Grindr users who were using the app inside a government facility that did national security. So he started geofencing office buildings that belonged to various three-letter government agencies and seeing what Grindr users were using the app in those buildings and where else they went. And as part of this demonstration, he could see little ant trails moving all over the DC area and in some cases the country. Sometimes he saw people stopping at highway rest stops. Other times he could see where people lived. He could see if they were in proximity to other Grindr users sometimes and maybe make some inferences. So it was a pretty powerful demonstration to these national security agencies that, hey, there's employees, people who in theory do this stuff for a living and who have access to sensitive information, and they're broadcasting this very rich data set out to anyone that knows where to look and where to listen. And it's not just a Grindr problem. He just chose Grindr because it happens to generate a particularly rich data set, because a lot of users really like swiping and it's kind of addictive. And also because LGBTQ Americans are, you know, they're particularly vulnerable. And historically, there have been some concerns about blackmail if people aren't out or aren't necessarily open about it. And so it was just a demonstration of the power of the kind of data that existed and how it could be just simply purchased, not subpoenaed, not stolen or hacked, but was just out there in these sort of opaque marketplaces.
Yeah. So where did he buy that data?
So it turned out he was buying the data from a commercial vendor called Uber Media. Uber Media is plugged into this intensely complicated network of advertisers and advertising exchanges that deliver banner advertising. And, you know, Uber Media, part of its business line was to save a lot of the data that was on these RTB networks. That's real-time bidding. So every time you see a mobile phone display app ad in an app, if you shared the location with that app, all these advertisers get it. All these companies like Uber Media are sitting on this ad server. In some cases, there are thousands of them. And some of them can just slurp the data. They can just save it. And an entire business model emerged about selling, saving and selling this kind of data to commercial entities. And then eventually governments got into this market.
So Grindr really opened the eyes, I think, to a lot of folks about opened the eyes of a lot of folks in Washington about what was possible in terms of using commercial data to carry out surveillance. But it was 9/11 that really kicked off the use of commercial data, as you document in your book. And I'm wondering if you might talk a bit about how 9/11 became a turning point in the government's use of commercial data.
Yeah, so 9/11 was important for many, many reasons in our history. But one of them is that the focus of our intelligence agencies had to change a lot, right? Because in the 1990s and before that, our intelligence community was largely focused around observing foreign states, trying to figure out what foreign militaries were doing, trying to figure out what foreign leaders were doing, sometimes hunting individual spies. But by and large, the most of our attention was focused at states. And in the wake of 9/11, all of a sudden, the government had to start tracking these tiny networks of people that were operating all around the world, sometimes blending in with the local population. And they had to try to find terrorists in a larger population that was not terrorists. And that was an incredibly difficult challenge. And so, you know, in the days and the weeks after the attack, the FBI started putting together this chronology that showed you know, all the steps that the hijackers had to take. And in doing so, they relied on a lot of consumer or commercial data records. So where these hijackers rented hotels, where they went to the gym, what rental cars they used, where they traveled, all that was really important in reconstructing, you know, sort of the pre-attack movements of some of these hijackers. And so there started to be this idea inside government and outside of government that, hey, there's large stores of consumer and commercial data out there that America's largest corporations have. And in many cases, some of them are sharing it with data brokers. And those data brokers have existing data businesses. And possibly, maybe that data could be used to prevent another terrorist attack. So the idea became, why don't we try to scan for these templates? Why don't we look for suspicious behavior in large amounts of corporate data? And so you would see projects like the Total Information Awareness Program and some other programs that the FBI and others were running using commercial data to try to sort through large volumes of data and separate sort of the law-abiding citizens from people who might be up to no good.
Who are these data brokers, and where are they getting the data that they're selling on to government clients? What does this economy look like?
Yeah, so it's a very strange market. Most of these companies, even if they're billion-dollar companies or bigger, don't have much of a consumer presence or a consumer relationship. Most ordinary consumers, when they think of big tech or big data, they think of something like Google or Facebook. The book I wrote largely focuses on companies that people have never heard of. The original data brokers sprung up in the 1960s, and they were basically doing very basic demographic information, nothing that you wouldn't find in a phone booth at the time, but they were sort of taking, a phone book at the time, but they were sort of taking it and collecting it and putting it in a data bank and making it available for sale across the country. Then they would start to do early demographic stuff. So maybe they could marry address records with census data, or then they started branching into sort of maybe consumer data sets. So modeling things off of, say, magazine subscriptions. So if you subscribe to Dog Fancy, what did that say about you as a consumer and how could we target you versus if you subscribe to Golf Digest or something like that? Mm-hmm. It was very basic sort of data aggregation on the whole country. Eventually they'd expand internationally. But over time, as the social norms changed, as the amount of data we were all generating changed, as technology changed, different kind of data brokers sprung up to deal in different kinds of data. So eventually, data brokers sprung up to monitor the social media conversation. Eventually, data brokers sprung up to characterize the movement of phones or cars. And eventually, data brokers sprung up to do things like ad targeting on the web, or, you know, to target you as you move around the world. And so all sorts of different data sets became available, and data brokers sprung up to take advantage of this market at every turn.
So 9/11 happens. The U.S. government has this realization that they want to turn towards commercially available data to try to prosecute the war on terror. Like, what is it that the U.S. government ends up doing with commercial data post 9/11? How does that get implemented?
Sure. So, I mean, essentially, I've found that whatever mission the U.S. government is, or even some local governments and local public safety officers, whatever their mission, they're probably finding some use for commercial data. I mean, I think the earliest uses were these projects to try to look for sort of templates or suspicious behavior. So the Total Information Awareness Program, right after 9/11, stood up by John Poindexter, who had some tangential involvement in the Iran-Contra affair. He kind of has a second act in his life and comes back into a government program. And what they're doing is this is a research effort, so it never really fully sort of matures and comes into operation. But what their idea was to take large stores of consumer data, you know, things like medical records and consumer purchase data and travel records and whatever you could sort of vacuum up, and combine it with the government's classified data, and then start looking for patterns or templates that might indicate suspicious behavior. So did you buy a bunch of fertilizer And did you rent a Penske truck? And did you, you know, make a bunch of hotel reservations from Texas to Washington, D.C.? Well, those three things in combination might be a suspicious template, whereas each one individually is nothing suspicious at all. So that was sort of the original aim. But, you know, as time went on, you know, the special forces and the military found that, you know, in the days of early days of ISIS and other jihadis, they were started communicating on social media. So social media became a very important data set for the military and the intelligence community and eventually the local police, right? Because protesters during the, you know, the Freddie Gray protests in Baltimore and the Ferguson protests, they were talking on social media. They were taking pictures of things they were doing and police wanted to monitor it. So social media became a very important data set. And then eventually mobile phones became a way to sort of understand the movement of people and things through the world and networks of people. And so that data set became important for, you know, counterintelligence and military operations and counterterrorism. And then increasingly now we live in a world where there's all sorts of weird wireless data. There's all sorts of bizarre internet logs. And sometimes those things are for sale. Whatever mission the government currently thinks is the top of their priority, that data is being repurposed for that.
Yeah. So one of the things that I really like about your book is how it functions as this history of the internet, but told through the lens of how governments and corporations use and misuse data. It's really like fascinating trip through the past 20 years of internet history in that way. And I was recommended on that basis alone. And of course, you know, you mentioned it a bit there, the big turning point of the last 20 years, right, is the arrival of social media and how individuals suddenly start broadcasting all kinds of things about themselves and their surroundings. How does the government try to utilize this data? I mean, what kind of projects are they spinning up to try to take advantage of this kind of revolution in human behavior on the internet?
Yeah, so it depends what government agency, obviously, but you know, I do trace some early efforts by the military to try to figure out where people who were affiliated with ISIS were and what they were up to, and to try to untangle their human networks. In some cases, a lot of these people who joined ISIS were actually very, very sloppy and very, very careless, and especially for people who kind of were committing violent acts against. And squaring off against the most powerful military on earth, they're doing things like taking pictures of themselves at various combatant commands with, you know, people who they're living alongside, or they're leaving their geolocation attached to their tweets. So the military figures this out pretty quickly and realizes that this is an intelligence windfall, right? Because never before have they kind of squared off against an enemy so willing to use open social media and open networks, both to recruit, but also to propagandize. But the flip side of that was it made them much easier to target. And, you know, there's some stories in the book about various ISIS members leaving their geolocation on and sometimes being visited by a JDAM or a fighter plane. And then, you know, eventually as time goes on, the police departments in the United States realize that this is very useful for trying to keep tabs on activists during times of civil unrest. Some of the big controversies around the use of social media came first during the Michael Brown and the Freddie Gray protests in the wake of their deaths, Black men at the hands of police departments. And there was a lot of civil unrest then, and you know, there was a lot of lawful protests, and most people were probably out there peacefully expressing their opinion, but there certainly were people that that were causing damage, that were rioting, that were throwing bricks. And so the police realized that social media was an easy way to keep tabs on some of these protesters and to try to monitor activist spaces. And so increasingly they bought access to these vendors that were selling tools that let them do that.
One of the, you know, other kind of big turning points in recent internet history that comes up in your book and has a important consequences for how government approaches data, or rather what data is available to the government, is the Snowden revelations. How did the Snowden revelations kind of affect the data that's available to the government, and how does the government's use of data shift as a result?
Yeah, so I can't, you know, a lot of the pre-Snowden intelligence programs are still shrouded in some level of mystery, even though Snowden gave us a pretty decent picture of some of what went on. And, you know, the full trove still has never really surfaced. It's still in the hands of a small number of journalists and researchers. But as far as I can tell, it seems like the government pre-Snowden had a lot more access to sort of the backbone of the internet. And in having that access, they could see a lot of things, right? They could see, you know, people's Google Maps queries, or they could see advertising data that was transiting unencrypted over fiber optic cables and other telecom infrastructure. After Snowden, you know, these tech companies got angry. There was a backlash, and a lot more encryption got put on data that was being sent over public telecom networks. And so, you know, the government sort of lost some visibility into networks that they had previously been able to access. And it just so happened, I'm not saying there's a conspiracy here, but it just so happened that as they were losing access to things like the advertising data that you could see on the crossing the telecom networks, at the exact same time, some of that data pops up in the commercial market, right? And so, you know, they, on the one hand, some of it went dark. On the other hand, now there's suddenly a new market for this stuff. And so they realized in some instances that they could simply buy the marketing data that they once saw when they were, you know, tapping fiber optic cables or, you know, undersea cables. And so it was just an interesting sort of coincidence that as the government lost some visibility, they were also seeing this robust commercial market for advertising data, social media data, and all sorts of other things spring up almost at the exact same time.
So we know that the government is buying ad data in some sense, right? But there's also a huge limitation to what we actually know about how the government is using this data. Like, can you just walk us through kind of the limits of your own knowledge right now, you know, when it comes to how the government is using advertising data?
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of these programs, most of them aren't classified per se, but they're closely held capabilities because governments don't want people to change their behavior. They don't want these capabilities widely known. And that makes sense, right? We don't want adversaries to be tipped off to our surveillance system. The problem is that a lot of these technologies technically are relying on consumer consent. They're relying on people to willingly opt into them. And the government wants to conceal its role as a purchaser in this market. And, you know, to me, as someone that thinks about, you know, the public interest and about technology and about government, I don't think that's a particularly healthy dynamic, right? I do think consumers, you know, in their role as users of technology and people spending money on it, they should know what data corporations are collecting and where that data goes. And then people in democracies should understand how, you know, governments are using their data. And in almost none of these instances you know, the government and the vendors did not want to speak to me or any other journalist about exactly what they were doing with data, you know. From what I've been able to piece together, there's a fair number of counterterrorism programs based on consumer data. There's a fair number of sort of immigration vetting programs and sometimes some deportation and immigration enforcement programs based on commercially available data, including social media and the movement of phones data. There's some cybersecurity programs based on large amounts of internet data sloshing around. And there's plenty of sort of public safety and law enforcement programs based around monitoring social media, and in some cases, monitoring the movement of phones or cars warrantlessly.
So the kind of the final category of data that you talk about in your book is gray data. Can you talk us through like what you mean by gray data, and in particular, I don't know, how the cybersecurity industry relies on it?
Yeah, so gray data is a term that kind of came out of a conversation I was having with a longtime intelligence community official. And we were talking about the fact that sort of modern car tires are broadcasting this unique identifier. And, you know, the car companies have never really bothered to secure the encryption.
But yeah, tell us about that chip. Tell us about the chip in car tires today. Right. Why is there a computer chip in tires?
Yes, it's a radio frequency device basically that's inside car tires, and it's there as a safety mechanism. It's designed to tell your car's central computer that one of your tire pressure, one of your tires has low pressure. Totally sensible thing to mandate that cars have, and it's a helpful safety tool. The problem is the way it works is it's just a little wireless transmission, right? It's not a wired, there's no wire running from the wheel to the car's computer. It's a little wireless thing with a battery in it, and every, 10 years or something, you have to replace it. But the car companies have never bothered to encrypt the transmission, right? So it's a unique identifier, and it's every 90 seconds or at some interval is pinging out to anyone that wants to capture it. That here's my unique identifier. I'm Hyundai tire number 1234B, and my tire pressure is 42 psi. And of course, clever government agencies have realized that they can do stuff with this, or at the very least, they need to understand it as a vector or a risk. And there are companies that now advertise systems for public safety or for sort of traffic monitoring that use this identifier as a way to monitor how many cars go by. And it may well have penetrated deeper into some sort of tracking technology that's embedded in our roadways. I don't know. But in talking to this intelligence community official about this, I was asking, is this really open source intelligence, right? This is not what we historically considered open source intelligence, or OSINT. That used to be like reading the newspaper, reading a book, or trying to understand things that were monitoring foreign broadcasts. And he said, it's basically what we used to call gray literature, which is a subset of open source intelligence. That's stuff that wasn't traditionally published in a normal medium, but it wasn't secret either. So, just imagine you're a spy in 1980, and you're in East Germany, and you go to a trade show and you pick up a brochure. That's gray literature, right? That's not a traditionally published document. It's not a book. It's not a magazine. But it's not secret either. So maybe the term is gray data, right? Because it's data that's there for the taking. It's data that's generated as a byproduct of using a service or the web. And I go on to give a couple of other examples of it, the wireless data that comes off of modern Bluetooth devices, the Wi-Fi base station IDs that all of our homes give off, even internet logs like NetFlow data or DNS queries. All of that is gray data, I think, because it's sort of there for the taking. It's not a traditional data set. There are brokers that now have some of it, but they basically get it by taking it, or scooping it up or slurping it. It's an interesting and emerging category of data, and it's one that I think governments are interested in. I never quite got to the bottom of exactly what they were doing with some of it. So, for example, I think some of the internet data, the NetFlow and the DNS data, is useful in cybersecurity programs, but the extent to which it's being used in those and exactly how and what it's being used for, I never got to the bottom of.
I think NetFlow data in particular, I think is one of the more fascinating examples of gray data that you bring up. Like, for folks who might not be familiar with it, like, what is it? Who has it? What can you do with it?
Yeah, so NetFlow data, my understanding of it anyway, is it shows logs of computer connections. So it might show that you connected to a domain like wallstreetjournal.com. It doesn't say what you did when you got there. You can't see the transmission of the data, but it just says that, someone at this IP address connected to this web domain, and this is how long they stayed there. And, that could be potentially very revealing data if you're visiting interesting web domains like jihadi forums or other things. And so, I think there are some concerns about exactly who's collecting it, who's selling it, and who's getting it. And then if you combine it with other DNS data, like DNS lookups and other things, DNS lookup is like a phone book, essentially. It's how your computer translates google.com to the numerical IP address that you actually want to go to. That data can be revealing. And there are companies out there that sell it or broker it or trade it amongst each other. And so, they're clearly useful in very important cybersecurity programs, but a lot of the ways in which A, it's collected, and B, it's being used, are not exactly visible to the average person. Not that they know what DNS and NetFlow data is, but these things are, again, being done sort of in the shadows, and no one really wants to talk about it.
Yeah. I mean, the data environment that you describe in your book, it feels like a real Wild West between advertising data, social media data, gray data. It's kind of, it is, as you put it, right, like all out there for the taking, if you know how to look for it and if you have the money to buy it. How did we arrive at like this policy environment of it being a Wild West? How did we get here?
Yeah, I mean, so generally speaking, the Supreme Court in the 1970s carved out an exemption to the Fourth Amendment that basically said if you give information to a third party, you've sort of lost your privacy interest in it. That's core to your Fourth Amendment rights against unreasonable searches and seizures. And this was called the third party doctrine. And maybe it made sense back in the 70s. The original case line of cases was about like banking records and the numbers you dialed. And the court's logic was like, hey, you know, if you tell the bank who you send the check to, I mean, what expectation of privacy do you have there? But the problem is that in the modern world, to basically do anything, you have to tell some third party something, right? You have to tell your ISP, you have to tell a server somewhere, probably usually hundreds of servers, or that triggers this cascade of trackers everywhere, right? So you're telling third parties things all the time, and this doctrine is essentially, you know, very outdated and really opens this window into our personal lives where we no longer have a reasonable expectation of privacy because we've shared so much information with third parties. And separately, you know, Congress has in the past enacted sort of laws that restrict government from getting data that's not really protected by the Fourth Amendment. So I'm thinking of credit data, and it eventually moved to protect banking data. It even went so far as to protect people's video rentals in the 1980s when some nosy journalist went and got some Supreme Court justices' video rentals from a store. Or it was a nominee. It was Robert Bork from a store in D.C. But in the with the rise of the internet, I think Congress didn't want to quell innovation, and they were afraid of, after 9/11, they were afraid of the national security implications of putting too many protections in place. And so we essentially are in a time period where it's sort of still the Wild West when it comes to data brokers. And when it comes to sort of adult privacy, Congress has passed some children's privacy stuff in the past 20 or 30 years. But when it comes to adult privacy, Congress has basically done very, very little since the 1980s on any of these questions, and has just let this situation go on and on till we get the world we're living in now.
Yeah. The privacy debate in Washington right now is totally consumed by TikTok and the fear that it poses. And I was thinking a lot about TikTok as I was reading your book, and I'm just curious, how do you think about TikTok? And what do you think about, like, the kind of a meta question? Like, how do you think about the way that we talk about TikTok?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I would break the problem into two separate issues. There's the data privacy stuff, those are interesting questions. And then there's the sort of content propaganda issue, also a series of interesting questions. On the data privacy stuff, you know, the amount of data sloshing around out there, as I catalog in the book, is so great that I cannot imagine that TikTok, that banning it or forcing a divestiture is going to do on its own a tremendous amount to protect the privacy of Americans and the, to shield us from the threat that an adversary nation might be slurping up large amounts of our data. I mean, there are huge numbers of data sets available for sale. I do think Congress and the Biden administration have started to realize this, and there's an executive order, I think something passed Congress the other day unanimously, that would stop the transfers of Americans' data to certain foreign countries. So there is a tension on the issue beyond TikTok, but the data privacy piece of TikTok, I'm not all that sold on the idea that it's some unique and special danger. On the content stuff, I do think, you know, if you talk to national security officials, one of their biggest fears is that in the middle of some sort of geopolitical crisis where the U.S. and China are staring each other down in the South China Sea or some other hotspot in the world and are on the cusp of a shooting war, that all of a sudden 150 million Americans are going to start to see, you know, anti-war, pro-China content on their social media feeds, and that U.S. national security officials would have no good way of understanding if that was organic content representing, you know, genuine public sentiment, or if some foreign power was sort of subtly putting its thumb on a private company to do its bidding in the middle of a crisis. So I do think, in that scenario, potentially divestment could, could alleviate some of the concerns that national security officials have. And, I do think that is a real that's a real threat. I think we do know, we have seen China operate in that way to put subtle pressure on companies that are under its jurisdiction or its control to do things around content and around speech. And it's not, you know, it doesn't take a tremendous amount of imagination to think that they might do that at a critical moment in geopolitics.
So last question, a bit of news you can use. You spent the last 10 years kind of in the trenches of data privacy and trying to understand the technologies that we all use. How can listeners protect themselves online?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I mean, I assume you have a pretty sophisticated audience, so they're probably.
I think so, but I also wonder how sophisticated people really are. I think a lot of people have maybe. I almost count myself in this. I used to be quite vigilant, but in some ways, I think I've thrown my hands up a little bit and said, okay, this is the world I live in, and there doesn't seem to be much that I can really do without taking some drastic measures. Yep. I realize reading your book that I've gotten lazy.
I think, you know, there are certainly things people can do. First of all, I do think Apple and Google have made some interesting changes in the last few years that have addressed some parts of the problems I'm describing in the book, including they've made it more difficult to sort of collect precise and persistent geolocation from users without them being very, very aware that, you know, apps are doing that in the background. But I would just suggest that anyone who's listening, go through their settings and their app permissions and really disable anything that doesn't need access to something. In particular, I would say your photo roll, your photo camera roll is pretty sensitive. Your contact list is sensitive and your precise geolocation is sensitive. You know, if you're really paranoid, you can turn off the microphone permissions or the camera permissions. That's a great place to start. Beyond that, you know, if you're just worried about sort of the content and the privacy of your communications, there's lots of great things out there. You know, Signal and Proton Mail and WhatsApp and Apple's iMessage are all end-to-end encrypted. You know, some of them are better for certain uses than others. Some of them collect more data than others. But just by and large, they will actually do a decent job of protecting your privacy, at least the content of it, as you communicate with friends and family and sources if you're a journalist. And just finally, I would say that the economics of the internet are still kind of messed up, right? That if we think about it, a lot of these developers are only reacting to the situation as it exists, which is that lots of people just still don't want to pay for things on the internet. And when you don't want to pay for things and you expect things for free, that's when these companies start to monetize you. That's when they start to do sneaky things, because it's not free to make an app. It costs time and money. It costs, you often have to pay the salaries of coders. You have to rent server space. Often you need a lawyer to draw up a terms of service or a privacy policy. Often you need an HR person to do payroll and benefits. So it's never free to make any of this stuff. And when developers can't rely on members of the public to pay 99 cents or $1.99 for their app, well, that's when they say, well, I gotta eat. My employees have to eat. And that's when they start to monetize people's data. So I would, my biggest call to people is to stop relying on free services and to sort of grow up and pay for things and return us to normal capitalism, not surveillance capitalism, which is that you pay money for a service and or a good, and you know, that's how it works.
That's a great note to end on. Byron, thank you so much for taking the time to chat and your great work on these issues.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to Safe Mode, a weekly podcast on cybersecurity and digital privacy, brought to you by CyberScoop. If you've enjoyed this episode, please leave us a rating and a review and share it with your friends, your mom, your dad. Nobody wants to get hacked. To find out more information or to contact me, your host, please visit cyberscoop.com.